The census helps decide everything from public school funding to your congressional district, but a trial run has already shown some non-citizens are afraid to fill out the form.
And when you then have communities that are already weary of filling out the form, not wanting to fill out the form, that risks not having a fair and accurate count.
That's Anita Banerjee with the Chicago nonprofit Forefront. She joins us along with NPR's Hanzi Lo Wong to talk about the upcoming census. Plus, remember this battle cry?
Wakanda forever!
This past weekend, Black Panther fans gathered at the first WakandaCon in downtown Chicago, where they celebrated Black history, culture, and nerding out. We'll get a report. And are you sneezing and itching more than usual? You're not the only one. We've got an allergist on call to answer all your burning questions. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 later in the hour. That's all coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you enjoyed your weekend. Maybe like me, you're fighting allergies. Today, we're going to be checking in with a Central Illinois allergist to find out why it's particularly bad. Also, the mayor of Elk Grove Village joins us to explain why their suburban Chicago town is sponsoring the Bahamas Bowl. Plus, a report from the first ever WakandaCon that happened in Illinois this past weekend. But first, every 10 years, the federal government counts the number of people living in the United States. This is actually mandated by our Constitution. And the data from the census can determine everything from how many congressional representatives you have to federal dollars towards public schools, housing, and health care. Earlier this year, the Trump administration announced plans to add another question to the 2020 census form. Is this person a citizen of the United States? Well, since then, more than two dozen cities and states have sued the federal government over that citizenship question, including Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan. 2020 might seem like far away, but the Commerce Department is also accepting public comments right now on the census. And that period, the comment period, actually ends tomorrow. In a few moments, we're going to be speaking with a Chicago nonprofit that is hoping to get more people in Illinois to comment on the citizenship question. But first, to give us an update on these lawsuits, I'm joined now by Hanzi Lo Wong. He's been covering demographics and the 2020 census as a national correspondent for NPR. Hi, Hanzi. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nala. Thanks for having me.
Hanzi, you were at the Census Bureau headquarters late last week, and I know you've been digging into this issue from your Twitter account. It looks like you've been reading a lot of documents. Let's start, though, with the basics of this. These six lawsuits against the citizenship question, where do they stand?
Well, there are two lawsuits out of New York at the Manhattan Federal Court that are headed to possibly a potential trial that could start as early as late October. Right now, the plaintiffs there, which are mainly led by New York State, as well as it includes, of course, Illinois, as well as more than two dozen other states and cities, they are trying to get the Commerce Department, which oversees the census, to release additional documents. They're also preparing to do depositions, to do testimony, out-of-court testimony of various Trump administration officials to find out exactly why this question was added. So those two lawsuits are furthest along. We're waiting for a federal judge in Maryland to release his order, his ruling, on whether to dismiss the Maryland lawsuit, as the Trump administration has requested. And this Friday in San Francisco, two of those cases, the two remaining cases, are going to, there's going to be a hearing of whether or not to dismiss those cases. So six different lawsuits, all at various different points.
And what I know from these lawsuits, there's been a lot of paper and documents that have come out. What do we know about who and why the Trump administration decided that this should be part of the census?
Well, we know that on paper, at least, it was Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross who oversees the census. It was he who decided to approve a request from the Justice Department. In December, the Justice Department submitted a letter to the Census Bureau saying, we would like to see a citizenship question added to the 2020 census forms. And the reasoning for it in this Justice Department letter was mainly for the Voting Rights Act, and specifically Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has provisions to prevent racial discrimination. And the Justice Department was saying that we need to have a better count of U.S. citizens, voting age citizens, in order to enforce Commerce, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And just the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, he reviewed that request. And in late March, he wrote a decisional memo that approved that addition. And so the Census Bureau has been working according to those plans and planning to add that question to the census, to the census forms. But these internal memos and internal emails that have been released as part of these lawsuits, they show, they make clear that actually Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, he wanted to add a citizenship question to the census forms long before the Justice Department submitted its request, and that he and his staff actually contacted the Justice Department and asked them if they would submit a request. And we also have emails here documenting that Chris Kobach, the current Kansas Secretary of State, who used to co-chair, was a vice chair of President Trump's now defunct Voter Fraud Commission, he actually contacted Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, about adding a citizenship question at the direction of Steve Bannon, the former White House strategist. That's the wording that Chris Kobach wrote to one of Wilbur Ross's staff members. And so it raises questions about what exactly is the reasoning behind this push from Trump administration officials to see this question added.
And what's the main argument that cities and states are making against this question? Why? What's the legal basis for why they think this question does not need to be on the census?
Well, this really goes back to Census Bureau research. The Census Bureau is very careful before adding questions to a form because it is a very sensitive tool. And so past research has shown that asking about citizenship status could discourage non-citizens from participating in the census. And that could harm the accuracy of the census, which it is a census because it is a headcount of every person living in the country. And so to not have some people not participate, that means you're not having every person living in the country as part of these numbers, which are very important, as you had mentioned, to determining how federal dollars are distributed, as well as how political power is distributed around the country. How many congressional seats your state has, that is dependent upon these population counts, and also how many electoral college votes your state has when it comes to presidential election season. That has to do with your population count. And so these more than two dozen states and cities, plus other groups, are concerned that this will harm the accuracy of the census numbers and therefore have direct impact on their federal funding for their local schools, their highways, as well as their political representation.
My guest is Hansi Lo Wong. He covers this. He's covering all things about the 2020 census as a demographics reporter for NPR. And Hansi, as you've been talking to people all across the country, I wonder what you are hearing from local leaders and residents. Are there people who are saying they are scared to fill out the census precisely because of this census citizenship question?
You know, what's interesting is a few months ago, I went to Rhode Island, to Providence County, Rhode Island, which is where the Census Bureau has been doing a test run of the 2020 census. It's the only place that will see a test run of the 2020 census. And I spoke to a number of non-citizens, number of unauthorized immigrants with my colleague Marisa Peñaloza, and we were in a town, Central Falls, Rhode Island. Number of many people told us that they were afraid of participating. And what's interesting is that this test run of the 2020 census actually doesn't include a citizenship question. Because it was such a last-minute request, the Census Bureau didn't have enough time to add this to this form to test it out.
So you're saying, Hansi, they were already afraid to answer the census.
They were already afraid of participating, and they were citing the increased immigration enforcement by the Trump administration and lots of worries about what will the government do with this information that that we will provide personal information. Now, the Census Bureau does have federal laws that it has to stick to, Title 13, which requires, you know, the Census Bureau to protect this information, any information regarding citizenship status, other demographic information. They cannot release that information, personally identifiable information, for 72 years, until 72 years after they collect this information. And so there are federal laws that would fine Census Bureau staff members from releasing that information. But one thing to keep in mind, though, is that the Census Bureau can release anonymized information about specific demographic groups. And so one concern here is that, if you're a citizen or not a citizen, they can't say, some person is or is not, but they can say, you know, this neighborhood, this census block, has X percentage of citizens and X percentage of non-citizens.
Hansi Lo Wong's on the line with us from NPR's New York Bureau. I want to bring in a local Illinois voice into this conversation. Anita Banerjee is also with us. She directs the Democracy Initiative for the Chicago nonprofit Forefront. Hi, Anita. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Anita, as you're listening to Hansi describe all of this, I wanted to just first just ask you, have you talked to people in Chicago who also are similarly hesitant to fill out the census form, whether or not they're aware of the citizenship question?
Yeah, so Forefront is actually a statewide organization, and we started engaging on the census, I would say, as of the start of the year. We have formed a coalition called the Illinois Count Me In 2020 Coalition, which is an opportunity for nonprofit organizations to start advocating early and often on census outreach for a fair and accurate count in Illinois. And with the proposal to put the citizenship question on the census form, statewide, we've been hearing concerns from a variety of communities, not just immigrant communities, of you know, what that could mean and what the implications are. And so what we've been doing is starting to hold some community census briefings to bring many of those concerns to the light so that elected officials can start to hear and what those concerns are and see if they can take action.
Anita, apart from immigrant rights groups or immigrant groups, what other groups are you hearing from who are concerned about this question?
Well, there are other groups. You've obviously immigrant communities. You've got the undocumented communities, and you've got the mixed status families, right, that may have legal permanent residents as well as citizens and undocumented. But then you've also got a hard-to-count community of children, 0 to 5. And knowing what has happened, right, with the children raids earlier this year, that has been a concern among all communities of color because children 0 to 5 are part of all of those communities.
And as the public comment period, as I mentioned, ends tomorrow, what is your and Forefront's public comment when it comes to the next census? What do you want the government to know about this?
Well, first and foremost, we want the government to know that all residents of Illinois need to be accounted for regardless of citizenship. So putting that question on the form is going to be bad for communities. It's going to be bad for census data collection and bad for America. So we ask, you know, we ask Congress and the Secretary Wilbur, as well as the department, the Census Bureau department, to strongly reconsider that question. And the census form was going to have challenges alone, right? Like, as Hansi mentioned, it was tested for the first time in Rhode Island, and it wasn't tested in other parts of the country, and it's going online for the first time. So what does that mean for data collection in and of itself? And what does that mean for data collection in rural America, right? The majority of Americans live in rural communities. And if you don't have access to broadband, how do you report on even the remaining 9 questions, whether you put that citizenship question on there or not?
Before we get to more of why you think it's bad, Anita, Hansi, I wonder if you can jump in here and explain a little bit more about the census going online. What will that look like?
So this will be the first U.S. census that will primarily collect information online. What that looks like is that a lot of people will get a postcard directing you to a link and also an ID that you go to a website, log in, and then submit those questions online that way. If you don't get that postcard, you know, the census workers who do come to your door, if you don't respond immediately, they're going to be using iPhones, actually, to collect your information and entering it into their iPhones and submitting it directly through the internet to the Census Bureau. But it's important to point out, though, that it's not exclusively online, that the Census Bureau is still going to send out forms. You can request paper forms, and you can also, for the first time, dial a 1-800 number to give your information through the telephone.
And Hansi, as part of your reporting on not just the citizenship question, but the census in general, you actually did report about the fact that the census is having some problems with who's going to be printing that actual form. What's that about?
That's right. So this is a contract that was awarded by the Government Publishing Office, the USGPO, not awarded by the Census Bureau. And this is actually the single largest contract, printing contract, that the GPO awards for the printing of the forms. and NPR has obtained an inspector general report from the GPO, noting that this awarding process for this contract was completely botched. A $61 million contract awarded to a company that less than four months after it was awarded it, declared bankruptcy. And so a lot of questions here of how did government officials select a company that was such dire financial straits and also put this process really in jeopardy. Right now, the Census Bureau is looking for a new printer along with the GPO. They say they're trying to find one by November. And the head of the 2020 census at the Census Bureau says this will have no negative impact on the timeline preparations for the 2020 census. But I did speak with one former head of the GPO who says, you know, this puts a lot of pressure on a timeline that really cannot be budged, that you can't really move from. There are very hard and fast deadlines of when the census has to start and when data needs to be collected. And if there are any issues about collecting information online for the 2020 census, the alternative, the backup plan is to go back to paper and pencil, if you will. But if that paper is not there because the printers are not ready, that's a big question of what will happen to this census.
Oh boy. Well, we're going to take a break in a minute, but we are going to continue this conversation. We're speaking to NPR's Hanzila Wong about the census. We're also talking to Anita Banerjee. She's director of the Democracy Initiative for the Chicago-based, as she's saying, a statewide across Illinois organization, Forefront. You're always welcome to join the conversation. You can tweet your comments to 21STShow. And we will continue this conversation in just a minute. Hanzi, let me just ask you one quick question before the break. So right now, there's no printer for the census as it stands.
There's no printer for the census forms, for the 2020 census forms. They are planning to put out a call for new bids. And so we'll see. And the timeline is to get one selected by November. That's what the Census Bureau says.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Hanzi and Anita. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 2020 might seem far away, but not when it comes to the U.S. Census. The Commerce Department is actually accepting public comments until tomorrow. And we've been talking to some groups, including the Illinois nonprofit Forefront, about how they're feeling about the citizenship question. Hanzila Wong from NPR is also with us, talking about the different lawsuits, six different lawsuits that have been filed against the federal government over the idea of whether or not we should be asking people on the census if they are citizens. We've been talking about this issue with Hanzi and Anita. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. Anita, I wanted to go back to something that you were talking about before the break, which is that you said that if there was an undercount of residents in Illinois, that would be bad for the state. What areas of life do you think would be affected by an undercount across Illinois?
So as Hanzi mentioned, right, the census count impacts federal dollars and congressional representation. And for Illinois, a state that is perennially broke when it comes to a state budget, and understanding that we had a huge state budget fight just recently, that was a two-year impasse, we really rely on our federal dollars for our federal programming, understanding that there's a lot of influx with our state budget monies. That said, we know that the census count provides for federal dollars that are then accounted for the next decade ahead. And currently, Illinois receives about $19.7 billion annually in federal funding that then goes to 16 programs that are administered in our state. And so that, first and foremost, we need those dollars, right? In a state that's perennially broke, we really need that that in place. The second is congressional representation. So Illinois is one of the states that looks to lose not one, but two congressional seats from the census 2020. And so we really need to be coordinated in our efforts across the state to ensure that there's a fair and accurate count, because we need all bodies to be accounted for, all individuals, so that we can continue to have strong representation in Congress.
Hansi, as Anita's sharing her thoughts on this, and I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that the public comment period on this ends tomorrow, I wonder if there are people who are listening who might be discouraged or disillusioned with the public comment when it came, for example, I'm thinking about net neutrality recently. The FCC went against the vast majority of public commenters' feelings in that ruling. Is there any concern that the same thing might happen here, even if there were lots of people commenting, that the Trump administration, the Commerce Department, the Census Bureau is just going to do what they were planning to do anyway?
Well, I mean, honestly, I don't know exactly what the Commerce Department and the Census Bureau will do with these comments, but I do know that in past collections of public comments regarding other aspects of the census and other, American Community Survey, another survey that the Census Bureau does collect, that the Census Bureau does take public comment into account. And this is requesting public comments, not just about the citizenship question, it's about all the questions and about all the different planning for the census. And so it is such a big country that any local concerns, the Census Bureau is hoping this is an opportunity to hear those and to take that into account while there's still a chance for changes to be made.
Anita, are you worried about whether these public comments will be heard?
Yes, I am. But our hope is that they will be heard, and our hope is that there will be a number of unique comments provided so that the department as well as congressional leaders will take them into consideration. Our national goal amongst advocates is about 100,000 goals to be collected across the country. And I believe we've actually accounted for that already, but we'd like to continue to push far and wide so that we can acquire even more before the midnight Eastern time deadline tomorrow.
I should mention you can submit comments at regulations.gov. We will tweet that out. We'll have that at our website at 21stshow.org. Before we end, Hansi, I just wanted to go back and end by asking you about this timeline. We were just talking about this before the break. You were mentioning that this is the time of 2020 seems like it's a long ways away, but this public comment period is ending because they want to make sure that they have time to incorporate suggestions. Where are we on the timeline, and what is your sense of if this is proceeding as should be at this point in time when it comes to census collection?
Well, the Census Bureau's director has told me that he really hopes to have the final list of questions really wrapped up by this fall. It's unclear right now if this will be completely resolved by this fall, the citizenship questions, which is really the question in dispute here, because, even the federal judge here in New York has said, he expects whatever he decides, whatever comes out of these cases that are before him, he will not be the final word. He suspects that this will be appealed, however, whichever way it goes. And so this could drag on into next summer, which is really we're cutting it very close. If by next summer we still don't know if citizenship question will be on or off the census forms, because that has impacts of just preparing for a count that starts in Alaska in next January 2020. That is.
Wow. Well, that's NPR's Hansi Lo Wong, who's been covering this. He will continue. You can hear his stories on NPR as this process is going forward. I want to thank him, along with Anita Banerjee, director of the Democracy Initiative for the Illinois Nonprofit Forefront, for being with me. As I said, you can submit public comments on regulations.gov. Hansi, Anita, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
What comes to mind when you think about the Bahamas? Sun and sand? Maybe, though, not Elk Grove Village, the Chicago suburb on the northwest side of the city, announced last week that it's the new title sponsor of the Bahamas Bowl. That means when you tune into the college football game on ESPN in December, you'll see the, quote, Makers Wanted Bahamas Bowl. With Makers Wanted as the village's official business slogan, the bowl was previously sponsored by Popeyes. Elk Grove's Mayor Craig Johnson is on the line with me now. More to tell us about how this all came to be. Mayor Johnson, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on today.
What made you all come up with the idea? Where did that come from to sponsor a college bowl game, let alone one in the Bahamas?
Well, what happened was we've had a marketing campaign going for about 3 years now. and we were one of the television sponsors of the Chicago Cubs. It was a regional sponsorship. In other words, it hit like northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin, eastern Iowa, and northern Indiana. And we had a huge success out of that. Our vacancy rate dropped from almost 7% down below 3%, which is record low. Our hits on the website jumped dramatically every time the season started, dropped off when the season stopped. So we thought we did a great job hitting on a regional basis, and we were trying to think of a way to go national. And so I did. I inquired with the Super Bowl last year, and it was $5 million for one 30-second spot. Even the Academy Awards, I was quoted for six commercials, $2 million. So, you know, realized that was kind of out of our spectrum. So I was actually watching some bowl games last year, and my wife was sitting on the couch by me, and I looked at her and I said, what would you think of Makers Wanted Bowl right there in the middle left field on the screen? And, of course, she thought I was crazy, so I knew that was something to look at. So I brought it back to staff, brought it back to the board, and about 6 months later, here we sit with, for the first time ever, a town sponsoring a bowl game like this.
So when you say that, when you said the Bahamas Bowl, did you try to go through other bowls, and did you specifically want the Bahamas Bowl, or did you just try to see what was available?
Well, what we did was we looked, there was a number of bowl games that did not have a title sponsor. Hawaii Bowl, at the time, New Mexico Bowl, now they do have one, and the Bahamas Bowl. So we looked at several things. One, we looked at, you know, viewership, as you mentioned. We looked at, you know, logistics, where they play games, all that. And then we also looked at what conferences are tied into the bowl games. And one thing that jumped out at us pretty quickly was the MAC conference is tied into the Bahamas Bowl, which means one of the teams from the MAC conference, which happens to be Northern Illinois University, which is just an hour away from our community, is tied into that conference, so a potential player there. So we thought MAC being a Midwest area, the Conference USA is a Southern Midwest conference with kind of a local flavor to it. We thought that made sense. We also liked the fact that the games played at noon Central Time on a Friday, which gives people a chance to view it, whereas like the Hawaii Bowl is not played till 10 o'clock Central Time that day, which is kind of too late. So all that taken into account, plus one big thing too, Nyla, it is played in a warm weather climate. And as Chicago found out, Chicago and the Chicago Cubs have been working for some time to get a bowl game at Wrigley Field. Well, about a week and a half ago, they announced it fell through, and the main reason they fell through was the Big Ten Conference, which would have sent the team there, pulled all their teams. No one wanted to go to the bowl game. They said they don't want to go to a cold weather city for a bowl game. They want to play in a warm weather climate. Well, you don't get much nicer in the Bahamas.
No, you don't. Now, why did you go with Makers Wanted instead of, say, the Elk Grove? Would I get maybe it's Elk Grove Village Bahamas Bowl too confusing?
Well, no. What happened was two things on that. One, Makers Wanted is a trademark logo we have, and we've been promoting that for over 3 years now. So all of our television commercials in the past, radio spots, billboards, everything else we've done in the past, always goes Makers Wanted. Second thing is the NCAA prohibits two community names in the same title, which makes sense. It would be confusing, all that.
However, it would be confusing, right.
Yep, but we did get this from them. It is the Makers Wanted Bahamas Bowl, which follows our tagline we've used for 3 years now, but they are allowing us at the 25-yard line on the field to say Makers Wanted Elk Grove Village, Illinois. So that will be on the field, and that will be part of the logo around the field. So it will be well known that it's Elk Grove Village. But the key is this, Nyla, on this. If you go on Google right now, type in Makers Wanted, the number one thing that always pops up is our website. So it's there, and that's kind of a selling point. You want people sitting, you know, someone sitting in California watching the game going, what the heck is Makers Wanted? You want them to go on that Google and type it in and find us. So it's kind of a way to get people to think about it, made it tied into our business community. And so marketing-wise, we think it's going to be a good play.
And Mayor Johnson, since this news was announced last week, I feel like this has been an international news story in a lot of ways. How far away have you heard from different media outlets who want to talk about Elk Grove Village now sponsoring the Bahamas Bowl?
Well, we haven't heard back from them, but I do know this. It was thoroughly covered in India. I mean, it is all over the world. But we've heard, you know, I've heard from media outlets all over the place. We know just in America alone, it has 50 million views, not our website, but, you know, views out there on the different papers, the different TV stations, all that. So it is well known right now what's going on with this. And what's amazing about this is our goal was, Nyla, at the beginning, to get 95% of the benefit before the opening kickoff, which is in December. From what I heard from some of the top marketing people in this country, we got about 900 times our return just in the first 24 hours.
That's Mayor Craig Johnson talking to us about the Makers Wanted Bahamas Bowl, which will be December 21st in Nassau. You can catch it on ESPN. Mayor Johnson, will you be in Nassau for the Bahamas Bowl?
I've been kind of, and people that know me well, Nyla, know I'm not a big fan of flying. But in this case, I will make an exception. However, I do want to point this out. We've said this from the beginning. No elected official, no village staff member will have their airfare, hotel, or meals paid for except by themselves. So no tax dollars, no other funds will be used to pay for. If we go to the game, it's always on our own nickel. Even though we're working on behalf of the community, we want to make sure we show people this is not a junket. This is not a way to get from cold weather Chicago to go to warmer the climate. It truly is there to promote our business park. So if we do go, we're paying it ourselves.
That's Mayor Craig Johnson of Elk Grove Village. Mayor, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
And thank you very much. And like I say, keep our fingers crossed for Northern Illinois playing the Bahamas Bowl.
We will.
Okay.
When the superhero movie Black Panther was released back in February of this year, you could say it was kind of a big deal. Over its theatrical run, the movie grossed a worldwide total of more than $1.3 billion. It's slated to become the third highest grossing film of all time. It's also the highest grossing film ever from a black director. And excitement over Black Panther isn't going anywhere. This weekend, more than 2,000 people got together in downtown Chicago to celebrate the first ever WakandaCon. It was started by a group of three Chicago area siblings, and creators envisioned a place where fans could use the principles and themes from Black Panther to start bigger conversations about black community, history, and culture. On the line with me now, I'm joined by two Chicago Tribune writers, Darcel Rocket and Kristen Johnson, who are here to tell us how it went at the first ever WakandaCon. Darcel, Kristen, thanks for joining me. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, hey, Nyla. Yeah, so glad to be here and to be able to talk about WakandaCon. It was amazing.
Let's start with that. Darcel, what was the crowd like, first of all? Who came to WakandaCon?
Oh, it was everybody and anybody. It was, you know, young, old. I mean, kids in strollers with, you know, their faces painted, as well as, you know, the elderly with their faces painted. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was like you had been, like you dropped in Wakanda. It was, mm-hmm. everybody was donning the African garbs. It was, mm-hmm. it was beautiful. So you just looked out and there's a sea of blackness and black faces, and it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, where was this at?
It was downtown Chicago at the Hilton Chicago, so right off of Balboa, I believe, and right across from Grant Park.
So oh, that's in, right, and considering that it was Lollapalooza this weekend, that's pretty good attendance for most people trying to avoid the downtown area if they're not going to Lollapalooza, right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so it's fascinating to have this, almost like this two different worlds existing at the same time. So you have Wakanda on the taking up all of the bottom floor of Hilton Chicago, and then you go upstairs and you see girls, you know, in bikinis and glitter and flower crowns and all these different things. So it was a very interesting space to take up and also just to observe.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Darcel Rocket and Kristen Johnson talking to us about WakandaCon and the thousands of people who got together in downtown Chicago to celebrate this festival. We're going to be hearing a little bit more about some panels that they were on. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are the Chicago Tribune's Darcel Rocket and Kristen Johnson. We're talking to them about their weekend at the first ever WakandaCon. I know the creators of WakandaCon, the Barthwell siblings, wanted to create the space where the movie Black Panther could act as a jumping off point for larger conversations about blackness in our culture. Kristen, do you think that happened at the conference this weekend?
Definitely. I think the film, played a huge role in encouraging the Black community to, just do a better job or continue to do a good job of coming together. 'Cause in the film, we see a Black continent or a Black country that has never been colonized. And so we see what that could look like if we had never had all these different types of trauma inflicted upon us, right? And so, it did a great job of showing us what it would look like and encouraging us to come together. And so there were a couple panels actually that spoke directly to that, where there was about just culture and community and change and the different elements of our lives, whether it be career and relationships, of how we can just do a better job of, being one people.
Darcel, what panel were you on? What was the focus of it?
It was focused on entrepreneurship and the gaming world. And everybody's heard of, Fortnite and the gaming in that sense. But this is more of the traditional gaming. So cards, we are living in a town of cards against humanity. So we talked to three ladies who are making it happen on their own terms. So I spoke with Kenyatta Forbes, who is the creator of Trading Races, which is a card game. You guys all have to check that out. It's fantastic. I feel like both me and Kristen bought the game after we heard about it. And other ladies, one is actually the owner and creator, Leah Avery, Hip Hop Charades. And the other one is Aston Hayes, who created an app called Tip Off that basically has people playing the game of like words that have been blacklisted. And so basically you can play it to people around the world. And all these are young women in our community who are, trying to make their own mark in the gaming world. And it was fantastic. It was well attended. And I feel like, a lot of people got a lot of information out of it.
And Kristen, I heard you also had a pretty big special moment at WakandaCon. So when I ask you what your favorite moment is, I think I know what it's going to be.
Definitely. So my boyfriend proposed to me at the closing, I guess, ceremony, if you will, of the convention. It was all things magical and perfect. And I was totally shocked. And Darcel actually had a role in it as well. She's been keeping the secret from me for a couple of months. And so it was so, so, so sweet. And afterwards, just so much love from all the people who came to the convention. There was literally a line of, just other attendees waiting to just congratulate me and my fiancé and just tell us that what we did, yes, was for each other, but also impacted the community and was a part of uplifting the community, encouraging just Black love. And so it was an incredible thing to be a part of. And, it was just like a family reunion. So that was, like you said, yes, absolutely my favorite part.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm sure
that's made the first ever WakandaCon even more special, certainly for you, but for everyone else who was there, too. I want to thank Kristen Johnson and Darcel Rocket. We'll tweet out their coverage as well of this if you want to learn more about what happened at WakandaCon this past weekend. Thanks for being with me, ladies.
Yeah, thank you, Nyla.
If you're like me, then in addition to enjoying the summer weather, you may also be suffering from some late summer allergies. According to the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, tens of millions of Americans suffer allergy symptoms related to trees, grass, weed pollens all year round, but especially bad right now, or at least it sure feels that way. What can you do? Amy Jessup is on the line with us from Carl in Central Illinois. She's a nurse practitioner who specializes in allergies. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And we want to hear from you. You can call in with your questions, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. 888-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. Amy, I think we typically think spring is a big time for seasonal allergies. I know in central Illinois, when corn is being cut in the fall, that's kind of always a little time that's tough for some people. But it's August. What's going on?
That's right. You think of spring, and that's just when a lot of the pollen starts, but pollen is continuing. We get lots of pollen from mold, especially right now. We're still having trees and flowers making pollen. Other things that cause allergies right now are insect stings. But the big thing in the fall that people have is trouble with pollen from ragweed, which starts in August and goes through November.
Okay. And I wonder if you can help us with some definitions here, because people often throw around the term hay fever. What is hay fever exactly? Are we using that correctly?
Yes, that's always so funny to me. Hay fever really has nothing to do with hay. It's what people are using to describe allergies that happen in the fall. Allergic rhinitis is allergies that are making your rhino, your nose, itis is inflamed. So hay fever has nothing to do with hay, and it typically doesn't have a fever. Allergies in general aren't usually going to make you go over a temperature of 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So it is funny. Symptoms of hay fever or allergic rhinitis is what it's really caused. They are just sensitivities to airborne molds or pollen.
So how can you tell if you're having symptoms that are allergic ones, or if you do have a cold or an infection? For example, I've had really itchy eyes. They've been kind of like very weepy. I know that means allergies, but for other people who've never experienced that before, they might think maybe they picked up a cold or even pink eye or something like that.
Right. So you can have a lot of different symptoms in your eyes, but with allergies, typically you are going to have the itching, the watering, the sneezing. Allergies don't typically cause fever over 100, so that's usually indicating something else is going on. If you're having aches and pains or you're coughing up colored sputum, those things are typically not just allergies, so you would want to be seen and get that checked out.
Okay. And are there other things that you also need to think about in terms of when you definitely need to see a doctor, when it goes, maybe when it crosses the line from just being an inconvenience or uncomfortable to something where it could be very dangerous?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes allergies can get pretty bad. And when you're talking about bee stings, other venom allergies, certainly with foods and medications, you can have severe reactions known as anaphylaxis, which is just a severe reaction that happens quickly. Other than that, that definitely needs to be seen by a doctor. But if you're getting swelling in your lips or tongue or your face or your throat, if you're having trouble breathing or if your asthma gets triggered by allergies, you need to be seen. If you're lightheaded or if you're getting a rapid or weak pulse, nausea or vomiting with these symptoms, you certainly need to call 911. You need to get to the doctor. If you have an auto injector, let's say if you have a bee sting allergy and you start having these symptoms after a bee sting, you want to use that auto injector with epinephrine and call 911 as well.
We're talking to nurse practitioner at Carl, Amy Jessup. Our phone number, if you have questions, by the way, or comments, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. Amy, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how to handle it this time of year. So you're talking particularly, you're mentioning ragweed. It's been raining a lot. What do you think are the best home remedies? First of all, let's start with adults before we get to children.
Okay. Some home remedies, I mean, the big thing, it's like if you're allergic to something, you want to avoid it. So how can we avoid these allergens when possible? One thing, and I know it's hard, we love to have our windows open, but keeping your windows closed, air condition on, especially before 10 o'clock in the morning, that's when pollens are the highest, is before 10 a.m. You can also do saline rinses, a nasal saline rinse like a neti pot, or nasal saline rinse where you're doing distilled water with a little bit of salt water and you can buy them in packets. That takes not only the allergen out of your nose, it rinses it out of your nose and your sinus, but that salt's going to open things up as well. That's really helpful because you're removing what you've just breathed in from your nose. HEPA filters are great inside to catch allergens in the home, like any animal dander or dust. And then using an air conditioner or dehumidifier, the dehumidifiers can help remove moisture because mold grows in moist, warm areas. So we want to get rid of that. And then for dust inside, if you wash your bed linens weekly, that helps get rid of some of those dust mites. as well as if you've got lots of pillows, stuffed animals, put those in the dryer for 30 minutes, and that can kill off some of that dust, the dust mites.
And what about for kids? I think a neti pot is a great thing for adults. It might be harder to get a kid to stick something. Well, some kids like sticking things up their nose, but in this case, when you're shooting water, I feel like it's kind of an uncomfortable thing.
Right. They typically stick things we're not supposed to stick up our noses. But yes, if your child will even do a nasal saline spray, a rinse is better, but a spray is good. Making sure that, well, if they have a dust allergy, you know, washing their beds weekly, getting rid of as many stuffed animals as you can. The ones you have to keep, you want to dry those. Make sure that you have them see an allergist if you think that they're having any allergies, so we can take the best care of them and you can take the best care of them. You can also keep a diary and try to see what symptoms trigger them. Kids can also take allergy medications. Most of them are safe down to certain ages. So it's good to see your healthcare provider, see an allergist, so you can figure out how to best take care of your kiddos, because unfortunately seasonal allergies can start in childhood.
And I wanted to ask you about childhood and allergies. There's been a lot of research lately. I was reading some research this weekend about how more they think having dogs or pets in the home are actually maybe good for kids when they're younger to be exposed to those sorts of things, because then maybe they don't have those allergies later on in life. When we're talking about babies and infants, what can parents do to create an environment that maybe would maybe prevent less allergies later on in life?
Well, that is definitely a hot topic in allergies. There is some data that shows that exposure to certain allergens can help their body induce tolerance on their own. That is somewhat of an exception to the rule, so I would certainly do it alongside your healthcare provider or your allergist. But they are finding in general our immune systems, after we've been avoiding this and that for so many years, are kind of making our immune systems a bit more immature, to where they're flipping out about things that previous generations didn't have any trouble with. So definitely work hand in hand with your provider, but it does seem like some early exposure to certain allergens can be helpful. Of course, if they start displaying symptoms, you know, if they're around a cat or a dog and they start having symptoms, of course you would not want to continue to expose them.
And what point do you start with your pediatrician? Do you recommend with children and allergies, and then they can recommend you to an allergist, or what point do you take your child directly to an allergist?
Yeah, I think that starting with your family provider is a great way to start. If some insurances don't require a referral, you can self-refer, but many insurances do require you to go to your family doctor and then get a referral to an allergist. And many family medicine providers and pediatricians are very well-versed in allergies. I think it's great if you're going to go forward with the testing and need a little more information. We've got several great allergists in the area.
Amy, before we end, I just wanted to ask you about the rest of the year. You mentioned hay fever. I'm just thinking about, we haven't gotten to the fall yet. It's August. It's kind of miserable for a lot of people. Do you think that this is not boding well for people with allergies for the rest of the year if we're already at this point in August?
Yeah, hay fever is a really hard time because people's immune systems really don't like ragweed, and then you get the mold on the corn, and when they start harvesting, that's flying around. My best advice would be get in with your provider, see an allergist. If you already have an allergy regimen, we typically recommend starting that about 2 weeks before your allergy season, and ragweed typically shows its face for the first time around August 15th. So for our ragweed people, I'd say get on your medications now and be ready for this to hit.
That's Amy Jessup. She's a nurse practitioner at Carl in Urbana. Amy, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, as you get ready to get your kids off for school and college, are you thinking about all those costs? We're going to be talking about financial planning for your family. If you have questions, you can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. If you have questions about financial planning for families in particular, that's part of tomorrow's program. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone, and you always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download. Then you can set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. You can also find us, if you have the NPR One app, through your smart speaker or on iTunes or Android. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, as I said, send us an email or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Penlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. Have a good day.